From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the two worlds of Sylvester Monroe. He was raised in a notorious Chicago housing project, but through scholarships, educated at prep school and Harvard. His new book tells his story and the life stories of friends he grew up with in the projects. Also today, I speak with horror writer Patrick McGrath. He's been described as a Poe for the 80s, a postmodern gothic storyteller who revels in tales of madness, decay, and the supernatural. Ken Tucker reviews the new James Brown album, and Stephen Schiff looks at Coming to America, Eddie Murphy's new film. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Sylvester Monroe grew up in a huge ghetto housing project on Chicago's South Side called the Robert Taylor Homes. He got out of the ghetto in 1966 through a scholarship to prep school, which in turn led him to Harvard. Monroe learned to live in the two extremes of American society, poverty and privilege, but he never felt completely a part of either world. Sylvester Monroe is now a national correspondent for Newsweek, covering the White House and politics. In the spring of 1986, he returned to the Robert Taylor Homes and asked the friends he grew up with if he could write about them for Newsweek. With the help of several colleagues, Monroe profiled his friends, showing the range of experiences of black men who came of age in the ghetto in the 1960s. It was published as a Newsweek cover story in March of 1987 and has been expanded for the new book, Brothers. Sylvester Monroe told me that his interest in writing about black men in America was in part a reaction to other stories on the subject he'd seen in the media.
The media seemed to have rediscovered in the last 3 to 4 years the so-called underclass. And in all the stories and specials that you would see, or most of them, it was from the women's point of view, mother-headed families, teenage pregnancies, and you never saw black men. They remained, in Ralph Ellison's phrase, invisible men. One of the stories that I did see that particularly annoyed me was a CBS special done by Bill Moyers entitled The Vanishing Black Family.
Right.
One of the few black male images you saw was of this young man who had fathered 6 illegitimate children. And he was asked by the interviewer why he kept doing that. And he says, well, I don't know. I guess I just got super sperm or something. And he says, well, who's going to take care of all these children? And he said, the state, I guess. Well, anyway, I was very upset by that because it was an accurate portrayal of what happens in, I believe it was Newark, New Jersey, in public housing projects like the Robert Taylor Homes, which is in Chicago. But it was not balanced. It was not fair. I mean, you didn't see the other side. And therefore, that's how we decided to come up with the idea to look at men and to do it from the inside out, not the usual sociology and statistics. Everybody knows the ghetto pathology. But from the inside out, to let the men speak for themselves about their lives and the world around them.
Well, I think meeting many of your old friends for this story was an occasion for you to reflect on your life, and that's what I'd like to talk with you about. Can you describe for us the housing project that you grew up in?
Sure. The Robert Taylor Homes is the largest public housing project in the country. It's 28 16-story high-rise buildings that stretch for about 2.5 miles along State Street, the main street in the city of Chicago. They opened in 1962. Oddly, when they opened, they were sort of heralded as an innovative concept in public housing. In fact, for my family and for many of the families of the people in this book and others, the Robert Taylor Homes represented the best place many of us had ever lived. I mean, my family had lived in one sort of rat-infested, roach-infested tenement slum after another. And moving here, I mean, here was a place that was new, it was well-kept, all the appliances worked, it was warm in the winter. It was just really, it symbolized hope and a new beginning.
Did it stay that way for long?
No. A couple of things happened. One of the things that made, the Robert Taylors are a much different place today, than they were in the mid to late 1960s. When we moved in, one of the things that characterized is that the people who lived there, we're talking Robert Taylor Homes, at its peak, had 27,000 people, all poor, all black. Now it's about 19,000. But even though it was a place for poor people, the people there were black people who had come up in the post-war migration from Mississippi, from the South. And even though there weren't always two parents in families, the families were very strong. They were church-rooted. They had very strong values, and parents had control of their children. Today, parents are much younger, and they don't exercise that kind of control. We're talking about 17, 18, 19, 20, 20-year-old, 21-year-old girls trying to raise families or raise children. In Jesse Jackson's phrase, babies raising babies. They can't exercise that control. The influence of the church is not as strong as it was. These young people cannot impart the kind of values that mm-hmm. our parents did. I mean, we were in gangs. Also, the gangs were just taking hold then. For us, being in the gang was not because we were gangsters. I mean, as tough as we were in our own minds, I mean, we're talking about guys who were supposed to be tough who had to be in the house when the lights came on.
Right.
And if, you know,
what,
I mean,
what your mothers had counted, your mothers really had authority.
Yes, they did. They had authority, and we respected that authority. Mm-hmm. That's changed. One of the reasons it's changed, as I said, is the difference is of the family structure. The other is the impact of drugs. Drugs were something that, for us, I mean, at that time, we knew what marijuana was and that sort of thing, but it was something that, quote, bad boys did. And we didn't do that. Now, the impact of cocaine and crack and the enormous amounts of money that can be made have made the projects a much more violent and dangerous place to be.
My guest is Sylvester Munro, a reporter for Newsweek and author of the new book Brothers, which is about the lives of he and his friends from a Chicago housing project where he grew up. When you were in school in Chicago, you were very smart. Your friends nicknamed you Brainiac. Did you like that name and like having the reputation of being the smart kid?
Oddly enough, I didn't particularly like the nickname. And, I mean, as kids, adolescents at that age, you really don't want to stand out. You really don't want to be all that much different.
And it's sometimes not a compliment to be called smart when you're young.
That's right. I didn't try not to be smart, but I also didn't sort of push it. What I really wanted to be was cool, like the rest of the guys on the street. I mean, I looked up one of the guys, Half Man Carter. I mean, he could dance, he could sing, he had girlfriends. He was one of the first of us to ever get little summer jobs and term time jobs after school and on the weekends. So he had money. Was pretty good with girls. He dressed nice. And those were the things that I really kind of wanted to be. I went to school. I mean, I did not do well in school. I went to school because of my parents' influence. But no, it was not necessarily a compliment.
Well, you got into a special program to go to St. George's School, which is a prep school, and it was called the ABC program, which stood for A Better Chance.
Right.
Did you want to go? Did you want to leave your home and go to Rhode Island to go to a prep school?
Absolutely not. I mean, I was doing pretty well at Wendell Phillips High School, which was a little bit up the street from the Robert Taylor Homes, 4,000 students then, all black, a school with a reputation for the worst of everything. Mm-hmm. But yet, I was going to school there, and I was sort of just coming into my own. I was learning about girls, and I was getting straight A's. I was on the track team, and really starting to come into my own. And I really didn't want to leave my family, my friends, this environment where I didn't have to work that hard. I worked, but not that hard. And now they were telling me that I had to go to a place which, you know, to me was like a galaxy far, far away, in Newport, Rhode Island, somewhere I'd studied in social studies and geography. I did not want to go. My mother, however, in her wisdom, recognized that this was an opportunity that I really couldn't pass up. And basically, I knew, too. I knew that my life would change, mm-hmm. would never be the same. So I went, but I went with the intention of coming right back. My mother said, you don't have to. I mean, she said, just go and check it out. See what it's like. If you don't like it, you can come home. So,
well, actually, after a few weeks, you asked her to come home, and she refused to let you come.
That's right. She said the only way I could come home was in a box.
Tell us the story of what happened when you got to school and one of the teachers looked at your clothes and told you to buy new ones. What were you wearing?
I was wearing my best Southside Chicago street garb. which I and when he with this teacher who was my appointed my as my advisor saw me, I thought he was admiring what I was wearing. I was wearing a big black hat with a black and white weave band, a long collar knit shirt, a pair of reversible pleated baggy pants, and a pair of black and white Stacy Adams wingtips, the kind that you could see the stitches, the white stitches around the soles, and a pair of dark glasses. He looked at me and he said, do you have other clothes? And I thought he was admiring them. He said, yeah, just like this. And the next day he took me off and bought me a blue blazer, two pairs of gray flannels, and a pair of black tie shoes, because he said my Stacy's would not do for Sunday chapel.
So you got the point pretty quick that you were supposed to look and dress differently than you were used to.
Yeah, different. He wanted to. I mean, it made me look the part of a St. George's school. I mean, New England boarding school, preppy. But I really wasn't, at least not yet.
Well, this brings to mind a statement that you make in your book. You say that the school prided itself on being colorblind, but to you, that sometimes meant colorblind was that, well, black people could be just like white people. Mm-hmm. Is that how it seemed to you?
Yeah, that's it, and it's one of the great myths about what integration was all about, the struggle for integration, which was it was never really about black people mimicking white people and being like them and sort of shedding their exterior, because in effect that really can't happen. I mean, the one self-evident thing about me as a black American, as a black man, is my blackness. I mean, even if I wanted to, I could not escape it. If when I walk out into the street in the morning, the first thing that people see is that blackness.
Well, if you were expected to change your clothes and dress more of the part of a preppy, were there certain emotions, certain feelings that you were supposed to trade in for new ones as well?
Exactly. I mean, I was one of the things. Well, a teacher. I'd been there for very long, and a teacher once came up to me and asked me and said to me, "You must be really happy to be and grateful to be away from that awful place where you came from, the Robert Taylor Homes." And he was flabbergasted when I said to him that I was not, that in fact, I was a little bit resentful that I had to go more than 1,000 miles to get a good education, to leave everybody that I knew and loved, my family, my sisters, my mother, my brother, all my friends, back on the south side of Chicago, as if there was something different about me than them, that I was somehow better than them. And I never was comfortable with that idea, with that notion, and have always resisted it. And that is part of what Brothers is all about, this book, the kinship between me and those guys and the kinship between all black people.
When you were in Chicago, you were seen as a brainiac, the smart one, the intellectual kid. When you were in prep school, were you seen as the tough guy just by virtue of having come from a Southside Chicago housing project?
A little bit, but I didn't play that up. I mean, I really... The funny thing was that I had a hard time getting the white kids at the school. There were only about 5 of us black students at the school when I arrived. No black student had ever graduated from St. George's. And I had a hard time getting them. I would tell them stories about the south side of Chicago and where I'd come from and the Blackstone Rangers, which was this burgeoning street gang at that time, which would soon to become one of the most fierce and largest street gangs in America. They just simply didn't believe it. I mean, they sort of looked at me with this disbelief that I was making up these stories. But I didn't try to come off. I mean, the thing was that when I was at St. George's School, for the most part, I acted the part of you know, a young prep school, boarding school student. But when I went back to St. George, I mean, when I went back to the Robert Taylor Homes, on the other hand, I shed all of that, and I took none of that home. I never wore that blue blazer and those gray flannels back down on 39th Street.
Well, did it feel kind of schizophrenic to have to be two different people depending on which world you were in?
It very much, and it created, what it also did was created a bit of anxiety about who I was and what I was and where I belonged, and an incredible amount of guilt. I mean, for the first, I was at St. George's for 3 years, then I graduated and went to Harvard, and by the time I got to Harvard, I mean, the guilt was something, I mean, I didn't dwell on it, but it was always sort of there in the back of my mind, because at Harvard University, I lived in a dorm that overlooked the Charles River, beautiful sunsets, great big picture window. I lived much better than I had ever lived in the Robert Taylor Homes or anywhere else. And there was a certain amount of guilt about the fact that I had left my friends who I thought, you know, why can't they have this opportunity? Why didn't they get this opportunity? Why is it just me? Why is my mother and my sisters and brothers still back in the, on the south side of Chicago?
Well, I want to talk with you more about what that period of your life was like. But first, we have to take a short break. My guest is Newsweek reporter Sylvester Monroe, who's written a new book called Brothers, about growing up in a housing project and also about his friends who grew up there with him. And he looks at what happened to them in their lives and what happened to him in his life. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Sylvester Monroe is my guest, author of the new book, Brothers. When you were in Harvard, and you got to Harvard in, was it 68?
69.
69, okay. Well, this was about the time that a lot of college students were becoming very political or becoming dropouts in a way, spending less time on schoolwork, more time on either political actions or taking drugs, having sexual relationships, things like that, and paying a lot less attention to school. What was that like for you to have your encounter with Harvard, you know, coming from like a ghetto housing project? Here you are at Harvard. You're supposed to really be hunkering down and proving yourself and, you know, proving that a black student can make it in Harvard. And students all around you are probably deciding, well, the heck with academia. They're gonna like hang out.
Well, I too got caught up in that. In fact, I was almost kicked out of Harvard my freshman
year.
For taking over buildings.
Oh, right.
I took over, I was part of a group that took over University Hall freshman year. And, I mean, it was a bright, wide-eyed time of idealism. And we were going to change this. We came in, we were going to change this 330-some-odd-year-old institution at that time. And the problem was that you know, we figured, I mean, we bought the myth. I bought the myth that here was the best and the brightest in the country among of students. And we were going to come in and tell Harvard how to do it and tell them what was wrong. And it took me a good 2 years before I realized, before I finally came to realize what I was there for and that this institution was simply not going to change because I said, a 19-year-old black kid from the south side of Chicago said it should change. I was one of the luckier ones. There were some people who simply never did make the adjustment that to sort of hunker down and realize that we were there to get an education and not change the world.
When you had become radicalized and were taking over buildings, what about your friends in Chicago who were still living in the housing projects? How did activism play out there, and did they relate to your new radicalized politics?
They did not. As a matter of fact, what happened was, as I went away to school, about a year to 18 months after I went away to prep school, many of these guys, not all of them, many of these guys dropped out of high school and went to the Army. A couple of them picked up that sort of activism in the service, in the Army, and came back. But one of the guys who didn't go, I remember one of the guys came back wearing a dashiki and dark glasses and sort of black power thing. And Half Man Carter, who was, I mentioned earlier, one of the guys, and he never went away to the service, never went away anywhere, really came back and says, nah, we don't do that down here on Trey 9. So down on the block, that activism never really picked up. I mean, even though we'd lived through the periods of urban riots in the late 60s, 67, 68, and then the death of Martin Luther King, the riots, that never really caught on down on 39th Street in the projects. The agenda down there was sort of just staying alive.
Did you try to politicize your friends, or did that seem not right?
No, I'm not sure why. I mean, I just had this feeling in the same way that I never took the blue blazer and gray flannels of St. George's School back to 39th Street. I also never took that activism that sort of political activism back to 39th Street. I just felt that if it wasn't there, I mean, that it wasn't natural. I mean, I still did not want to rock the boat, and I still very much wanted to be accepted by my friends on the block. So, no, I did not. I continued to live two completely separate lives.
Sylvester Monroe is my guest. He's a reporter for Newsweek and author of the new book, Brothers. He grew up in a Chicago housing project and went on to prep school in Harvard. And that's partially the subject of his new book. The rest of the book is about what happened to his friends who grew up in the same housing project. In your book, you write, "I'm neither a true preppy nor a ghetto banger. I am rather the peculiar product of an even more peculiar hybrid of American experience." Do you find yourself in a position now where you really want to find other people like you who know both of those worlds and are a part of each but aren't kind of in the middle somewheres or not? I don't
actively look for those kind of people. I've actually become very comfortable with who I am and what I am, and that, and finally stop. I mean, it's just one of the things about doing Brothers. I mean, it was kind of a catharsis. I came full circle in my own life, and I looked, and I suddenly realized that really I don't have to choose one or the other. I mean, I don't really belong in either place. I certainly don't belong on 39th Street, and I don't belong, in off Capitol Hill in Washington D.C. where I now live. But that 39th Street is where I'm from. And that, in fact, I'm a privileged character because I have two windows on the world and a dual window on the world. And what I do in my job as a national correspondent for Newsweek and just as a human being who has this experience is to try and get people in both places to just accept that there may be a different way of looking at the world. Not that you have to agree with it or accept it, but that it just accept that there is another, a valid point of view, a valid worldview, that if you just stop for a minute and think, it's valid and it's legitimate, even though I may not agree with it, we've made a little bit of progress. That's what I try to do. That is the point of Brothers. It was to get Newsweek readers and people who will read this book, hopefully, to look at the place, people who would never go to a place like the Robert Taylor Homes and who have in their heads a preconceived idea, notion about what goes on there and who lives there and what life is like there, to realize that really who lives there are people with the same dreams, hurts, hopes, needs, wants as everybody else. It's just that their lives are circumscribed by race and poverty and the isolation of living in a place like the Robert Taylor Homes.
Now, you've told us before when you used to go back to the Robert Taylor Homes on school breaks that you wouldn't bring, the college clothes, that you wouldn't bring certain politics that you had started to believe in and take part in. Now, when you went back to the Robert Taylor Homes as a Newsweek correspondent to write the story about the lives of your friends and what kind of adults they had become and how, what did you feel comfortable taking back all of the things that you had become, dressing the way you dress on the job, or
if there was any discomfort, it was about what I suspected, what I knew and suspected I would find, and how I would handle it. I mean, these weren't just any old subjects. I mean, I'd been back to the Robert Taylors over the years. That's what made this possible, and I think ultimately, the way that I went back, I mean, because these guys could have resented me. I mean,
well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, well, here I am, a successful Newsweek correspondent, and I think I'll write about you guys.
But that's not the way.
Right. I'm sure it's not the way you did it, but it, you'd have to be careful for it to not be perceived that way.
Oh, and there was some suspicion. I mean, when I went back, one of the guys, Ulysses Sonny Spruill, looked at me and said, "Vest, are you the man? I mean, are you the police? Why are you here?" And it didn't take me long to convince him that I wasn't, but the point is that he asked, and he was serious. Another of them, Gregory Bronson, looked at me and said, "I'll do this for you as a favor, because you asked, and, we were friends, we are friends, and I'll do this, but you know and I know that those white people you work for are not going to do any kind of positive story about black men." There was that skepticism. Ultimately, these guys did it because, and I think because, even though I never had this in mind that I would come back and do this and that I would need to an entree back in with these guys, I really did feel that kinship. And so I never went back sort of beating on my chest talking about, look at what I did, look at who I am and what I am now. If you had done this or that, you could have been just like me. I simply went back as Vest Monroe. I mean, I didn't make any any, there was no pretense that I was still one of the guys on the block. I mean, they knew that I was a Newsweek correspondent, but I treated them in the same way that I always had. Ultimately, I think Half Man Carter gave the best answer as to why these guys did it. He said to me, in 36 years as a black man, no one had ever asked me what I thought about anything. And, you know, it's not every day that most people get a chance to have that kind of forum in Newsweek to talk about themselves and their lives, and certainly not black men.
The person who was nicknamed Half Man was your best friend when you were growing up. What happened to him now? What's he doing now?
Well, Half Man sort of epitomizes, I mean, of these 11 guys, you've got a real spectrum. I mean, this represents a kind of microcosm of what happens to black men in America. I mean, not that all black men are grow up in housing projects like the Robert Taylor, but there were some guys who were very successful, some who were not. And in the middle are guys like Half Man Carter, who, as I said, worked hard. I mean, breaks the myth about black men in housing projects like the Robert Taylor's that they are lazy. Half Man, the one thing that I remember about him is he always had a job from the time he was 13. Sometimes he had two jobs. But while we looked up to him when we were 16 years old because he had money in his pocket and he had a job and he had nice clothes, that because he dropped out of school and opted to take that to work and make that money, the money he makes at 37 now is not much different than the money he made at 16. But still, he works. I mean, he believes in the work ethic. He's never been on welfare. And what he says is, you know, he chooses work. I mean, and that's black America. That's the bulk of black America. It's not the Vess Monroes. It's not the Ray Stinglys, who's a successful pharmaceutical salesman, guy who grew up in a family of 12 children. It's not Hunk Johnson, the guy who looked around and decided that there was no possibility of him making it in the straight world. So he became a hustler. He's today doing 8 years for armed robbery. Or Billy Harris, who became a basketball player, professional basketball player, but when the ABA folded where he played, he found himself back on the streets. They're in the middle. The guys who haven't made it the way we, I mean, haven't had that big break, but haven't turned to drugs or crime, they just work hard every day trying to make ends meet.
And you think that those are the people who are the most invisible?
Yes.
We have just 2 seconds left. Tell me really quickly, do you think a big trap that a lot of successful people who had a hard time making it fall into is thinking, well, if I made it, why can't other people?
It is a fallacy because, I mean, we are one person, and the point, one of the points of Brothers is the interchangeability of our lives. Hunk Johnson could have been Vess Monroe. Vess Monroe could have been Hunk Johnson if just a couple of things had gone a little bit different. I was lucky, and defining luck as the intersection between preparation and opportunity. I got some things from my family, love, support, a sense of self-worth, and a pushing toward to understand that the importance of education that made it possible when the doors of opportunity swung open in the late 1960s for me to take advantage of it. Those guys didn't have that same push, that same break.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Newsweek correspondent Sylvester Monroe. His new book, Brothers, is about growing up in one of Chicago's biggest housing projects. It's about him and about the friends he grew up with. It's published by Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Eric Hansen. He's an inveterate traveler who's written a book about his walk across Borneo and back. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Patrick McGrath says he was a normal, well-adjusted child, even though he grew up next door to an asylum for the criminally insane. Now he says he's a normal, well-adjusted adult, even though he writes haunting horror stories. Coming up, we meet Patrick McGrath and learn about his fascination with decay. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker looks at the enduring influence of James Brown. The Godfather of Soul has a new album. And Stephen Schiff has a review of Coming to America, Eddie Murphy's comic fable about a pampered African prince who travels to New York's slums to find the perfect woman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A Soviet Communist Party official today called for the removal of two members of the party's Politburo. The official said the Politburo members and two other party leaders should be punished for their active support of past policies that led the Soviet Union into a long period of stagnation. Details from NPR's Ann Cooper.
One target of the attack was longtime Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko, who now chairs the National Legislature. The call for his removal came during a special National Party conference convened by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to debate political reform. Gorbachev presented a blueprint for political change on Tuesday, but when he turned the floor over to the 5,000 conference delegates, speakers turned their attention to a long list of grievances about the economy, the party, and nationalist issues. The conference debate is expected to continue into the weekend. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
South African police say a black man was killed today when a bomb he was trying to detonate went off outside an art gallery in Johannesburg. That incident came about 12 hours after a bomb blast in the capital city of Pretoria injured 14 whites. There were no claims of responsibility, but the government says the explosion was the work of the outlawed African National Congress. Mike Hanna reports.
The blast occurred at lunchtime in a crowded downtown restaurant. Among the injured were two children, but none are in a serious condition. It's believed the blast was caused by a limpet mine placed underneath the counter in the restaurant. A police spokesman has warned the public to be on its guard, saying that further such attacks can be expected. He's added the fact that the mine was placed in a public place is proof that the African National Congress, or ANC, is now intent on hitting at civilian targets. The explosion took place near the spot where 19 people were killed in a car bomb explosion in 1983, and is the latest in a series of low-key bombings, which the government says is part of what it calls an ANC terror campaign. For National Public Radio, this is Mike Hanna in Johannesburg.
Another day of unrest in Israeli-occupied territory today. A 17-year-old Palestinian was shot and wounded in a clash with troops during a funeral in the West Bank. The army closed six West Bank schools following violent demonstrations over the past few days. An Arab teenager shot by soldiers 2 weeks ago died today in a West Bank hospital. And in East Jerusalem, several car windshields were smashed and two Arabs were arrested following a rock-throwing protest by dozens of high school girls. Israel Radio said police used tear gas to disperse the stone throwers. Speaking to reporters in Jerusalem today, Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said the army has reported a recent drop in violent incidents in the West Bank and Gaza, and Shamir said the Palestinian uprising is coming closer to an end. U.S. debt rose to $368 billion last year, an increase of $99 billion from the year before. Today's report by the Commerce Department shows that foreigners now own about 5% of all the assets in the United States. Economist Alan Sinai says even higher foreign debt and wider federal budget deficits hurt the economy and can be felt in higher interest rates and real estate prices and wild swings in the prices of stocks and bonds. Sinai calls the growing debt a long-term problem with unknown consequences. Bright sunshine in the Midwest and forecast for more of the same set off another buying spree in the grain markets today. A weak band of thunderstorms earlier this week provided little relief to the main growing regions of the Midwest, but heavy rainfall did soak several counties in Kansas, and soybean farmers in the Mississippi Delta benefited from a band of drenching rains. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped more than 19 points to close at 2141.71. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The hardest working man in show business has the most imitated scream in all of music. James Brown's frenzied footwork, his flowing capes, songs like Hot Pants and I Feel Good guaranteed him a place in rock and roll history. But Brown is no fossil. He's just released a new album called I'm Real. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Talk about postmodernism. Here's James Brown on his new album, I'm Real, talking about the nature of his own music, how he's still around to make it, and remarking on how so many younger acts have come along to, quote, steal my rhythm and my style. As pop self-consciousness, this is fairly breathtaking, since it's also framed around some of the best music Brown has recorded in a good long while. And what Brown is asserting is not idle boasting. The primal, rhythm-rooted funk that Brown developed in the early 60s is all over the place in current popular music. His stripped-down beat and chanted vocalizing can be heard in the music of New York's hip-hop movement, Washington's go-go music, Chicago's house music, and the Minneapolis scene that yielded Prince and the production team of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. These days, James Brown's always hoarse voice is more fragile than it ever was. Occasionally, his screams are less expressive and his vocal cords sound frayed with use and age. Nonetheless, a new song like that one, called Time to Get Busy, is powerful and immediately commanding. Credit for this should also go to Full Force, a Brooklyn group that records its own albums and works as a production team as well. Full Force wrote and produced 9 of the 10 songs on I'm Real, and the album operates as the group's extended salute to the Godfather of Soul. It's an artful updating of Brown's 60s sound, done in a style that carefully accommodates the latest rap record technology. Veterans of the early rock era are forever launching misguided comebacks like this, but Brown's effort with Full Force has been thought through with wit and moderation. James Brown continues to influence musicians, and there's an excellent, brand new example of this. One of the first generation of rappers, Afrika Bambaataa, has just put out an album called The Light. It's a series of collaborations with various musicians, including the British band UB40, the Jamaican reggae artist Yellow Man, and most important, American funk master George Clinton. You can trace a succession of funk development here. Brown was first, then Sly and the Family Stone, then George Clinton with his bands Parliament and Funkadelic, and then you hear the way young rappers like Afrika Bambaataa took this 20-year-old tradition and ran with it. All that is pretty clear on this song from The Light called Clean Up Your Act. James Brown is part of an increasingly familiar phenomenon, a first-generation rock act who passed through a period of artistic eclipse to find himself considered hip again, and more importantly, still capable of making music that speaks to a large, diverse audience.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Patrick McGrath grew up in a house on a hill 50 yards from the largest hospital for the criminally insane in England. His father ran the hospital and also saw patients on the grounds. McGrath worked at mental institutions for a while himself, but left that pursuit to become a writer. What he writes is horror fiction. He says he's interested in how the mind tends to deceive itself. His new collection of short stories is called Blood and Water and Other Tales. When I spoke with him, I asked him to read the opening paragraph from his story, The Angel.
You know the Bowery, I presume. It was on the Bowery that I first caught a glimpse of Harry Tallboys. I was a writer in those days, and I lived in a five-story walk-up by the men's shelter. I didn't realize at the time that Harry Tallboys lived in the same building, though of course I was familiar with the powerful smell of incense that contaminated the lower floors. It was high summer when I met him, high summer in Manhattan, when liquid heat settles on the body of the city like an incubus, and one's whole activity devolves to a languid commerce of flesh and fluids, the ingestion and excretion of the one by the other, and all sane organisms, quite simply, estivate. I was certainly estivating. I rose late in the day, and after certain minimal ritualistic gestures of the writerly kind, made my way to the liquor store. It was on one of these errands, on a garbage-strewn and urine-pungent sidewalk, beneath a blazing sun and slimed in my own sweat, that I first encountered Harry Tallboys.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that paragraph is because you get the sense of heat and of everything putrefying and oozing, and I think yes. that really is kind of follows throughout your stories.
Yes, I think in horror stories you do get a lot of rot, or in my horror stories there's a lot of rot.
Any reason for that?
I think that all horror stories tend to be obsessed with decay in one form or another. Horror stories prefer to be set in ruins rather than in sound structures. They prefer to deal with the madness of a crumbling mind rather than, with crystal clear sanity. They prefer shadows to daylight. And one particular instance of that sort of decay is in the realm of the biological.
Now, I think your writing has a certain Victorian sensibility to it. even the beginning of the paragraph that you just read, you know the Bowery, I presume.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you rooted in that period in some way?
I don't know. I suppose, you know, in the sense that distance always lends enchantment to the view, that there is a sort of charm to old and arcane forms. And in linguistic terms, or in literary terms, I find that those sorts of pre-modern forms of writing are simply very attractive to me. Those rather ponderous and pompous and long sentences full of semicolons and so on. I just delight in them.
Noah, Victorian times leads us to Freud, which I think leads us to your father. Now, your father was the superintendent of the Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum in England. Would you explain what the asylum was?
Well, it's not an asylum as such, because this is, in fact, Victorian terminology, and my father spent most of his career fighting against that particular terminology. It's a mental hospital, and this is the largest maximum security mental hospital in England, and it's where what are now termed the mentally ill offenders are sent. And these are men and women who have, while in a state of psychosis, have committed some particularly fiendish offence that demands that they be in maximum security for the protection of themselves and the protection of the public.
And what was your father's job?
My father administrated the hospital and also had a patient caseload of his own. So essentially, he ran the hospital. My father was eager that we should come to understand mental illness as simply one other form of illness, so that you know, his own family at least would not suffer from the sort of lurid illusions about insanity that were elsewhere in the society.
Well, that's nice, but look at the kind of imagination you ended up with.
Yes, I know. Something went wrong, didn't it? I tried for a long time to be a socially useful citizen, and it didn't work. It wouldn't take.
In your book, there are two stories in which there are pickled hands and two stories in which there are severed hands that take on lives of their own. Do you have something about hands?
Well, it's not so much that I have something about hands, but that this whole there is a strain within horror fiction of severed hands. And I was curious as to what it was all about, and was reading actually a biography of Malcolm Lowry. And in this biography, Lowry is told that being obsessed with severed hands is related to masturbation guilt. And when I read that, I thought, aha. And that's when I wrote the story called Hand of a Wanker, which, you know, explains that this is what severed hands are all about.
Now, there's another severed hand story that I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of. This is from a story called Hand of the Raj. And it's a story about a woman whose fiancé suddenly sprouts a hand growing out of the top of his head.
Yes.
And the hand strangles the man. The woman comes in, finds her husband dead, strangled by this hand. She lies down next to her husband's corpse. Mm. And then would you read from there?
How long she lay there, as the shadows gathered about her and the insects began their shrill and rasping chorus in the dusk, she would never know. But suddenly she became aware that her hair was being very gently stroked. Cecil, she murmured. Cecil, are you still with me? And in a way he was, for the dark hand growing out of his head had begun to softly caress Lucy's hair, and such was the lightness, the delicacy of its touch, that the demented girl did not recoil in horror, but remained sobbing on the corpse as the hand soothed her and calmed her and brought her slowly to a state of passive languor. And when it gently touched her neck, she still did not resist, did not leap back in disgust, but allowed the fingers to melt her pain to pleasure and revive the longings that had first been spawned by the hot sun of Suez. And once again, Lucy Heppelwhite was filmed with perspiration, and she moaned in the shadows of the body of her lover.
What were you thinking about when you wrote that?
I was just thinking, you know, what a gruesomely neat idea this is, that a man could be dead, but part of his body could remain alive, and that his fiancée could actually be seduced by this part of his body that still retained life somehow. I thought, this is the most bizarre idea I've ever had, and I was enjoying myself when I wrote that.
Since you're so interested in the gruesome, what do you do when you encounter something gruesome in real life? For instance, say you encounter a dead rat in which a lot of insects are feeding. Are you going to stare at it and really look at it so that you could describe it really accurately in your next story? Or will you avert your eyes and try to forget what you'd seen?
The first. I'll stare at it. I mean, I think it's interesting. Don't you? Wouldn't you?
Well, I'll tell you, I've actually been in this situation a lot lately because there's all these cats that live on my block, and they're constantly bringing me offerings. So, there's always, like, dead birds and mice and stuff outside my house. And part of me is really drawn to it, and part of me is just absolutely horrified, and I don't even want to look at it or deal with it. So I don't know. I have this kind of compulsive look, don't look.
Yes. Yes, I think maybe that's why we like horror fiction, if we like it. It's because we are caught with a sort of fascination and repulsion simultaneously, and the horror writer probably has to, you know, has to exploit that, that attraction, make it stronger so that you can enjoy your own repulsion while, you know, completely fulfilling your desire to look.
Patrick McGrath, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Patrick McGrath's collection of short stories, Blood and Water and Other Tales, is published by Poseidon Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Well, it's day three of the Communist Party conference.
It is indeed. We'll have a couple of stories on that. We've been following it. Today at the conference, though, there was a dramatic call to oust two aging Politburo members, one of whom, and this is why it's so dramatic, is President Andrei Gromyko. Also in Rome, Pope John Paul II excommunicated a renegade conservative cardinal by the name of Marcel Lefebvre after Cardinal Lefebvre ordained four new bishops, something only the Pope has the authority to do. And on All Things Considered tonight, we'll have a first. Victor Hernandez Cruz and Deborah Salazar square off for the heavyweight poetry championship.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Eddie Murphy is one of the reigning kings of comedy, but in his new movie, Coming to America, he plays a prince. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Every time a new Eddie Murphy movie appears, I find myself struck again by what a strange phenomenon his stardom is. Nowhere else in the history of the movies does one find a comic actor whose success is based on appearing all-powerful, invulnerable, impervious to the slings and arrows that taunt the rest of us. Coming to America is a lighter, milder, more pleasant comedy than, say, Beverly Hills Cop or The Golden Child, but its theme is still the fantasy of command. Murphy plays Akeem, prince of the mythical African kingdom of Zamunda, a youth so regal that he can't walk anywhere without a bevy of beauties preceding him to strew rose petals in his path. But Akeem has a dilemma. He doesn't want to go through with the marriage that his father, played by James Earl Jones, has arranged for him. He wants to find a girl with a mind. In fact, Akeem's situation is a little like Murphy's own. Murphy, too, is a monarch with a retinue of fawning courtiers, including his pal Arsenio Hall, who plays Akeem's courtier Semi. And Murphy, too, has beautiful women at his beck and call, but still pines for true love. For the actor, this problem may be insoluble, especially in light of the Neanderthal attitudes towards women that he exposed in his concert movie Raw. But for his character, Akeem, there's a solution. A wife-hunting trip to America. Where in America? Akeem and Semi resort to coin flips and maps to decide.
Heads New York, tails Los Angeles. We go to New York.
But where in New York can one find a woman with grace, elegance, taste, and culture? A woman suitable for a king. Queens.
It's one of the film's central gags that Akeem wants to find his intended in the poorest, slummiest place in America. And dirty, dangerous Queens should be the perfect place to make Prince Eddie seem winningly vulnerable. But Murphy and his screenwriters haven't even considered that. Akeem is too big-hearted to mind the degradation of slum life, and he's too adept in the martial arts ever to be in physical danger. In fact, the only real difficulties this movie can cook up for its awesome hero are the kind that seemed stale when we first saw them in some of the lesser screwball comedies of the 30s. Can Akeem convince his beloved that he's poor in order to make sure she loves him for his wonderfulness, not just for his money? On this point, the film gets tricky. Coming to America, like Arthur and Trading Places before it, is what I call a supply-side movie, a movie that pretends to espouse liberal, egalitarian values while subtly promoting Reaganism. In other words, it's all right for Akeem to appear poor, but it's not all right for him to be poor. The happy ending requires bushels of money. Murphy's performance in Coming to America is unusually gentle and self-effacing, but like Trading Places, the movie was directed by John Landis, whose work almost always has a crass edge. A lot of the story takes place in a fast food eatery where Akeem takes a job, and while the script keeps protesting that there's no shame in poverty, Landis delights in mocking the lowly French fry chef, whose goal in a couple of years is to make assistant manager. And there are a lot of laughs at the expense of the eatery's owner, whose taste is decidedly nouveau riche. Coming to America doesn't whack you over the head the way some of Eddie Murphy's movies do. It's a lot easier to take, and for that reason, a lot more insidious.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I speak with writer Gerald Gardner about the era of self-censorship in Hollywood. His recent book, The Censorship Papers, explores the workings of the Hays Commission, the censorship arm of Hollywood's production studios from 1930 to 1968. Also, humorist Al Gingold grows up and buys his first sofa. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the work of Polish composer and conductor Witold Lutosławski, as heard on the recent album Lutosławski Conducts Lutosławski. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.